Our next speaker is one of my oldest and dearest, most dear friends. I have known Steve Blake for more years than I can remember. In fact, for so long, I can't even remember how we first met. That might actually say more about my age than his, but Steve first got involved in the nationalist struggle as a schoolboy. He joined the National Front, and with everything that Steve does, he threw his whole self into it, and he became a valued member of their team. And later, when the BNP came along, he played an even more prominent role. In fact, Steve Blake is a man who has run the most successful political website there's ever been. At one time, he had more clicks per day on the BNP website than the Tories and Labour had combined, selling our message, telling the people about nationalism. And it was down to Steve. And he's playing a key role again for us in PA. In fact, I'm going to tell a wee story, actually. Steve once stood as a candidate in Scotland when he lived up there. And he got interviewed on a programme for Thistle TV. And as you all know, the people who know Steve, he's intelligent, he's articulate, he's knowledgeable. He presents ethno-nationalism in a sensible, modern way that's so positive. And he did such a great job on this one-to-one interview on this television programme that the politicians and the media team behind it cancelled the programme. They refused to put it out. Instead, they aired a different programme with a Labour MSP, the head of the TV company, and the interviewer, where they basically said they couldn't air this programme because Steve was so full of hate and the BNP mess was so full of hate. Incredible. However, we do have a copy of that interview, and I do promise in the next, however, months, our team in Scotland will air that out on the channel, because when you see the two things side by side, you'll know why we rate this man so highly. He's just amazing. In fact, he's such a good advocate for our people. He was actually one of the very first people I called to talk about Patriotic Alternative 2. And turns out he was already interested in getting involved anyway. But he's so, you know, he's much loved by more than me. In his region, I believe, the Young Lions in Eastern call him their captain. And in the next few weeks, Steve is hopefully going to be part of the team that is going to help get PA registered as a political party. We have been rejected again. Again. We've done nothing wrong. Everything that we have put in our application is stuff other organisations have. But they keep nitpicking and finding wee ways to stop us. And it's just spoiling tactics. Our first application was actually a duplicate of another political party's constitution, barring the name, and they rejected it. So they're just playing games. But Steve has managed to secure for us a meeting, a face-to-face meeting with the Electoral Commission, because we're not going to play their game. We're going to fight and we're going to get registered so we can start contesting local elections. So can you put your hands together for Steve Blake, please? Yeah.
Okay, thanks for that very noble introduction, Kenny. You failed to mention, apparently, that I'm a man so shady that birds fall silent within 50 yards of wherever I go. Well, put 150 unapologetic ethno-nationalists in a room, and can you feel the energy here this afternoon? It's absolutely fantastic, and I'm really honoured, proud and privileged to be here speaking to my first annual conference here for PA. The title of my topic is Makers and Breakers, looking at a broader historical context of our struggle. We are truly spoilt in Britain I could present one of many from a long list of literally hundreds or thousands of individuals who have made their mark in the realms of engineering, science, and technology. I could have chosen Sir Isaac Newton, the founder of modern physics. I could have talked about Humphrey Davy, an eminent chemist. But given the fact that we are here on the outskirts of Clitheroe, I thought I'd use an illustration of a local lad, if you like. Most of us travelled here today using the internal combustion engine. That's one over on Just Stop Oil. And we did so on roads that were, in the scheme of things, relatively well made and well maintained. Now, of course, like everything else in history, that hasn't always been the case. And up until the mid-1700s, travel in anywhere across the British Isles was arduous, it was perilous, and it was a thoroughly unpleasant affair. The tracks, such that they would have been thoroughly miserable trying to navigate in the wet months, mud, animal dung, and so on. And in the summer months when they dried out, the routes, the tracks would have been heavily, heavily rutted. Now, step forward, a chap who was born just across the way over in Knaresborough, in North Yorkshire. John Metcalf, he was born to a humble, poor family, and he contracted smallpox when he was just 6 years old. Now, Metcalf started out as an itinerant fiddler, and he was very good at what he did. And he soon accumulated, generated enough money to buy his own horse and cart, and he started his own transport business. Now, he soon realised that, yeah, this was a really arduous undertaking, and he was appalled at the state of the roads. He identified a problem, and he set about coming up with a solution to that particular problem that he faced. And it just so happened that there was a government commission at the time for someone or some group of individuals to come up with a design to improve the otherwise thoroughly miserable, muddy tracks that crisscross Britain. So after a series of tests, he came up with a solution. It was pioneering at the time. It was a three-layered setup of stones, coarse stones as the foundation layer, a middle layer of finer dressed stone, and on the top layer, he had shingle or gravel. And he also did something which at the time was very revolutionary. He realised that the major problem of the tracks was water, and he came up with a convex surface to his roads. We take these things for granted, but it was revolutionary at the time. And he also built a drainage ditch on either side of the highway. His one-mile test track was revolutionary. It won the competition that the government commission had set up, and he soon won further commissions to build, ultimately, a network of 180-mile network of stone roads across North Yorkshire, Lancashire, and Cheshire. These were the first stone roads. These were the first stone-made roads in the British Isles since Roman times. Now we take that for granted, but he, through his industriousness and the application of what we take for granted as the scientific method, he identified a problem. He came up with a way of addressing that problem. He carried out tests. In science, they're called hypotheses. He carried out tests, and he came up with something that was successful. Now, that is something ingrained in our Western psyche. We take it for granted. We identify a problem. We try to come up with a solution by trying, failing, testing, failing, until we find something that actually works. And then we build on that solution. And what happened within a very short space of time, after Metcalf had completed his 180-mile network of roads, other individuals came along. Thomas Telford, for example, and John McAdam, two Scottish individuals who came along and improved on the road network. Our people are constantly striving to improve their own personal lot and the lot of our society. And as I said, we take it for granted. It's not universal. Our industriousness and our application of the scientific method is not universal. The early European explorers who were opening up the vast expanses of South America came across native American Indian tribes. And while they were, generally speaking, hard workers and worked very well in those tropical and subtropical conditions, they found that they couldn't get them to work every day. They didn't turn up for work every day. They didn't turn up for work for maybe 2 or 3 days. It turned out that they only turned up for work when their bellies were empty and they needed food. So this idea of industriousness, the application of our work ethic, the scientific method, it's something that is unique to us as European people. And we've taken that right across the world. Now, I'm not going to criticize, by the way, that it's obviously a survival strategy that the American Indians have employed. So it's not for us to criticize. It's a completely different environment. It's just different. And the other thing is, our people are prepared to take risks. We take risks to improve our lot. We take risks to protect others. We risk our capital. We risk our reputation. And we risk our physical well-being. Our people have gone to all extremes of the earth. We have conquered and climbed the highest mountains. We have submerged to the depths of the deepest oceans. We have put people into aircraft that fly at 30,000 feet, and we've put men and women into space. We're prepared to risk in order to improve our societies and ourselves. Now, I'm not going to critique the concept of technology per se. It could be argued that the Industrial Revolution was an utterly bad thing, and everything that came out of it is being partly responsible for our situation today. I'm not going to critique that. Everything, every new piece of technology has benefits and has problems, positives and negatives. It's how we use that technology that's important. Okay, so the Industrial Revolution led to the production of pollution, toxic byproducts, electromagnetic radiation, artificial processed foods. Apart from that, so everything else was good. Now, even if we consider the Industrial Revolution to be a wholly negative thing, then we can look back at a slightly earlier period in our history and we can marvel at the beautiful Norman cathedrals that have been built across these islands, the Norman castles, great feats of engineering, the majestic spires that adorn the buildings in London, Cambridge, Oxford, Durham, York, for example. We can marvel at those, at the great designing spirit of our forebears, perhaps even more so, bearing in mind that they built those magnificent structures with very simple machines, mere tools, hammers, chisels, simple pulleys, and simple surveying equipment. So I'm using engineering here as an example of our dazzling brilliance. I could have used any other aspect of our lives, music, literature, art, and so on. The European ethos is that of creating stunning works in every aspect of our lives. We are unparalleled on this earth. We are designers, we are builders, we are creators, we are makers. Now, it is without doubt that we are entering a new dark age. Our Western civilization, which has been exported to all 4 or 5 continents of the world, now faces a fundamental civilizational crisis. To paraphrase Enoch Powell, we must have been mad to allow millions of people of alien cultures to come into our homelands. People who mock us, people who exploit our goodwill, people who absolutely hate us and want to see us dead. And when we're dead, they'll dance their tribal dances on our graves and they will destroy our legacy, either through violence or through neglect and abandonment. Now, such replacement and destruction has happened to other civilizations in the past, the classic one being Rome. And we can see what happens when the dominant European culture is no longer the good force for good and stability. We can see what's been happening in many of our own lifetimes, what has happened to former Rhodesia, what's been going on in South Africa, and across the Atlantic, what we have seen when, again, the great industrial cities that have been built by Western European people have fallen into majority, sorry, no longer the majority, and the great industrial powerhouses of Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Detroit are now cesspits of violence, incessant gang, drug, warfare, and the infrastructure is literally falling to pieces. But our fate doesn't have to be like this. Apart from the material war, there is an ongoing cultural war against our people and our ideas. And our ideals. Not just our ideas, but our ideals. There's an ongoing cultural war in the same way that there was a cultural revolution in China under the dictatorship of Chairman Mao. We see the same thing throughout our institutions. Academia, the media, law enforcement, education, and so on. The list goes on. Perhaps the most remarkable weaponization of our language that's taken place literally in the past few years is the so-called misgendering of individuals and this whole taboo about the incorrect use of pronouns. I mean, what on earth? What a complete load of guff that is. We have academic institutions, I'll try to keep a straight face when I say this, academic institutions issuing warnings to their tender little charges that books that have served previous generations of students perfectly well, they warn them that there could be offensive comments in these books that might be interpreted as classist, misogynistic, or racist. I mean, it does beggar belief. That these brilliant minds in our academic institutions are pandering to the supposed offences of a small minority. All it would really take is a few people within the particular institution to stand up, you know, a dozen of them, a couple of dozen of them, just to stand up and say the blinking obvious. There are only two sexes. Deal with it. But it's like the emperor's new clothes all over again. And unfortunately, we seem to have individuals, whether they're in law enforcement, whether in the media, whether in academia, they're either too cowardly to say the obvious or they're too comfortable and they just look at their monthly paychecks so they can continue their effete lifestyles and to hell with the rest of society. They really are a bunch of moral cowards. That's ultimately what that comes down to, moral cowardice. But really, those highly intelligent academics, they act in the way that they do because they're faced with a general lack of feeling of belonging. We, as ethno-nationalists, have a strong bond to those that came before us. We have a strong bond amongst ourselves living and breathing here today and our extended families and our colleagues and our comrades who couldn't be here. We have a strong bond. We have an identity and we understand the importance of that connection. We're not mere individuals. We are part of a growing community. These academics don't understand that. They're not part of that community. And that long-held, natural, organic relationship between the individual and the community has been broken. It's very difficult to see how it can possibly be repaired, if at all, under the present system and while that system endures. Now, it is far easier, anybody who studies physics or even maths at A level will know that it is far easier to break something than it is to make it. Let's take an everyday example. Let's take the example of a book. Now, it might take years for a novelist to assemble his or her array of characters and put together a plot. It might take an academic long period of time to conduct research in the field or in the workshop in collaboration with others. It might take months to put the finalized material into, well, nowadays I was going to say paper, but it would be digital format now. It takes an extraordinary undertaking of energy to create a book. And as Claymore Books know, the book has to be printed, bound, distributed and marketed. All those aspects take a great deal of energy. Now, that book can be ripped up in seconds. It can be burnt by a match in seconds. It takes an enormous amount of energy to make something, a lot less energy to break it. That's just a simple example at the micro level of a book. When we expand that, talk about our entire civilization. It took, I was going to say, from post-Roman period, it took 1,500 years to where we are now. In what short period of time our civilization will be fully broken, I do not know. We've seen some pretty wild examples of the cultural Taliban in action in recent years. And for me, the most remarkable one was a well-televised news event from 2020. It was the one activity that really pushed me over the edge, forgive the pun, pushed me over the edge, I'll come on to that in a minute, to contact Mark after a gap of 11, 12 years or whatever. You might even be able to guess what it was. It was that televised, frenzied mob, semi-feral mob, that pulled down a statue in Bristol in the summer of 2020, dragged it along and dumped it unceremoniously into a harbour in Bristol. That sculpture, it took 9 months of hard work and creative energy to create that bronze structure in 1895. It took approximately 15 minutes for the semi-feral mob of BLM supporters to pull it off its plinth, drag it along, and as I said, dump it into the harbour in Bristol. Now, as an aside, the trial of the so-called Colston Four was a travesty. The judge basically instructed the jury to acquit, or he didn't actually say do acquit, he said consider acquitting the Colston Four on the basis that the act of wanton vandalism, they're my words, not his, obviously, the act of wanton vandalism was a perfectly legitimate expression of their freedom of expression. And that outweighed all charges of criminal damage. Now, I cannot imagine for one moment that judge or a similar judge saying, and this is a hypothetical situation, a so-called right-winger hauling down the statue of Nelson Mandela and unceremoniously dumping that in the River Thames. That's hypothetical. Of course, that's never going to happen. It's hypothetical. Okay, 2 weeks ago, we saw a couple of dozy, decadent 20-somethings throw a can of tomato soup at the Sunflowers painting in the National Gallery. Now, I don't know if they actually knew, because I imagine they're not that bright, whether they knew that there was a protective shield in front of the painting itself. Doesn't matter. What they set out to be about to do was an act of wanton vandalism against an important piece of Western art, Western culture. The artist, Van Gogh, was a deeply troubled genius. He painted that in what was called one of his happy moods. We know that because there was a lot of orange and green, the colours of nature in the painting. He was dead 18 months after he completed painting that. He shot himself in the head. And forget the ludicrous price tag on that painting. It's something like $200 million. Forget that. It is widely regarded as one of the most magnificent pieces of Western art. And Van Gogh painted that, as I said, in one of his happy periods. He painted that as a mark of gratitude to his friend Gauguin, with whom he had a rather tempestuous relationship. He spent his creative time and energy and all that soul that he put into creating this masterpiece. And he said, it's a mark of gratitude. And we've got two decadent middle-class poncers, basically, destroying this magnificent piece, or at least attempting to destroy this magnificent piece of art. They are wreckers. They are breakers. They live in a nihilistic world where there's no morals, no standards, no judgments, there's nothing, no real end goal, just apart from vandalism itself and destruction itself. It's their world versus our world. What is our world? Our world and our folk, as I said, we are builders. We are builders, we're creators, we're makers. And Whereas their world is one of nihilism, our world consists of nobility, decency, honour, creation, discipline amongst ourselves, and constant self-improvement. We are the creators, we are the makers, we are the makers. Now, let us look back in history and see who emerges from chaos when a civilization collapses. When the Roman Empire was falling apart, when its effete, I often use that word, you probably noticed, effete and decadent rulers were still trying to govern the empire, the system was fundamentally rotten. The taxes were too high, the military were losing wars, security was weak, a bunch of spivs masquerading as government were using all that tax money and squandering it on pointless vanity projects. Might sound familiar. Literally, the aqueducts collapsed, and thus the supply of fresh water. And politically, the Roman Empire fell apart into dukedoms, principalities, and kingdoms, and so on. As the entire infrastructure fell apart, there was one organization that managed to function amidst the ruins. Its members had two important attributes. One, on a material level, they could read and write. Let that sink in for a moment. They could read and write. The vast majority of the Roman population in the dying days of the empire were illiterate. They were Roman in names only. In fact, it was a polyglot population of Egyptians, Arabs, Africans, Persians, and so on. And it's a slight aside here. It wouldn't be the first time that in my day job I have had to completely reject submissions from some younger members of the team because it didn't look as if they were writing it in English. And tragically, it also spills across into some of the younger recruits in our movement who believe that things called emojis and youth speak are apparently acceptable ways of communication. No, they're not. You have to stick to standards. You have to have standards. And if you want to communicate to the vast majority of people, at least try and speak and write in the same language that people understand. Now, perhaps a modern-day equivalent of the ability to read and write, and obviously reading and writing is absolutely essential, perhaps a more modern parallel would be the ability to code, for example. A society where a lot of its people can code or can configure routers or know how to run a power generation piece of equipment, that's useful skills to have. Anyway, back to the dying days of the Roman Empire. The successful group who survived the collapse of the empire held on to something also very, very important. Apart from the ability to materially write and read, they held on to their faith. They had an unbroken, undying belief in themselves and their cause and their faith. And it was their faith that helped them survive. And they went on to develop. You know who I'm talking about? It was the early church. Okay? It was the early church. Their adherents held on to knowledge which a century earlier would have been widespread, but it was now the preserve of a new emerging elite. And this is where I mentioned Patriotic Alternative for the first time in my talk. Patriotic Alternative is a vanguard organization. We have broken new ground in British politics, and we've shifted the Overton window so that the discussion of demographics and the white survival in our homelands is now an acceptable talking point. We have upset the establishment, and many of our people have faced barrages of hate-filled attacks by the mainstream media. All the result of literally a few hundred activists right across the country. Imagine what this vanguard organization could do if just double the number of people actually started to do something. Imagine what we could achieve if 10% of the people who actually subscribe to our mailing lists actually did something. Let us remind ourselves what our goal is, what our purpose is. Our mission is the self-determination of our kinfolk. Ethno-nationalism is the political means by which we will fulfill that mission. and future generations of our kind will live by that creed, that ethos, to ensure that we thrive and prosper for all time to come. Just as every other racial and ethnic group on this planet, we have a God-given right to exist. A God-given right to follow our culture and bring up the next generation of our children, valuing and loving who they are without any feeling of guilt. Ethno-nationalists, and that's us in the room today, and those of our colleagues that couldn't make it here today, ethno-nationalists are the true standard bearers of all those traditions, cultures that have gone before us. We are the true guardians and gatekeepers of our society. And while we may be yet small in number, we have achieved and can achieve a great deal. And we can look to other numerically small groups of ethno-nationalists across the world. They might not call themselves that, but external observation is clearly, I would say that it is clearly by definition, an example of ethno-nationalism and ethno-state building. We can look at what skill, industriousness, moral courage, risk-taking, go back to what I said at the beginning, risk-taking, all that can make up for small numbers. The first example, many of you will be familiar with, is that of Irania, in his best Afrikaner accent. Irania is in South Africa. It's one of two towns that have been set up in the past 30 years, and it's been established by Afrikaners for Afrikaners. Irania is a thriving town of nearly 2,500 people. They tend their own gardens, they have their own water supply, they empty their own bins, they look after their own sewage disposal. They are totally self-reliant in an otherwise inhospitable part of the Northern Cape. They have literally built a paradise in the desert. Now, the community doesn't accept any old Afrikaner speaker turning up. It carefully vets its applicants. Yeah, quality control. And that's what we have here in PA, quality control. We vet our applicants who want to become part of our community. Now, the applicants have to demonstrate that they understand the Irania ethos, that they have a skill that the community needs, and that they're able to function without any state handouts, and that they fit well into that community. There is a second and probably lesser well-known group of individuals, and that is the Mennonites. I don't know if anybody has heard of the Mennonites. The Mennonites are of German origin. They came from various parts of Germany, and because of the political persecution in the 1700s, they migrated westwards. And they set up communities in Canada, Mexico, Belize, Colombia, and the most important one is that in Paraguay. I'm not saying anything else about Germans in Paraguay. They make up 0.5% of the Paraguayan population. 0.5% of the Paraguayan population. They are responsible for 80% of the milk production of Paraguay. Why do Afrikaners and Mennonites thrive in environments which others might consider to be hostile environments? Both geographically, in terms of the North Cape, which is a semi-arid area, culturally and politically. Why did the early Christian church officials survive the chaos of the Roman collapse? Simple. They embraced that European work ethic. They operated the scientific principle. For example, the Mennonites, they're not quite as strict as the Amish. They're a bit selective in the machines that they use. They wouldn't be able to produce 80% of the milk production of Paraguay were it not for the fact that they use electricity they drive heavy goods vehicles and so on. So they're not as doctrinal as the Amish, but they embrace the work ethic. And there's one other thing, I have mentioned it earlier, one other thing about these communities, the Irania community and those in Paraguay, And it runs through every aspect of their society like the letters in a stick of rock. And that is that F word again, faith. Now, these societies cannot survive by facts alone. Science and facts alone. There's a brilliant opening line in the book called Hard Times by the brilliant author Charles Dickens. It says, facts, nothing else will ever be of any service to them. But societies, even the Victorian society, was not built on science and facts alone. Successful societies need cohesion, mutual trust, and group cooperation. Where will you find that? You will find that in societies with a homogeneous population. They also need an undying faith in themselves, which I've said, that they have a divine right to exist and an unwavering faith in their divine path to thrive, flourish, and prosper. This faith is fostered by knowing their history. I believe that history is very important. Learning about the great deeds accomplished by men and women who have gone before them. Reveling in the great treasures of their literature, their customs, their traditions, their folklore, their rituals and ceremonies. Not just those that mark special occasions or marking the passing of the seasons, but the all-important life-affirming celebrations that accompany birth and marriage and, sadly, the commemoration of the dead. All successful societies have to have laws and a moral code, which is proportionately enforced. After all, even primitive hunter-gatherer societies have laws to ensure the well-being of their tribe. A free-for-all doesn't work. Nihilistic societies do not work. You have to have these important building blocks. I've mentioned them: faith, cohesion, and so on. In tribal communities, even water supplies have to be treated with care. There has to be careful attention to the disposal of the dead, often accompanied by ritual and ceremony. And it's done so in a way to prevent the spread of infection and disease. Murder, rape, and dishonesty do not promote the tribal or community survival, and those who perpetrate those deeds are punished. Now, books can be rewritten, sculptures can be recreated, even churches can be rebuilt. Notre Dame was a classic example of Western industriousness and the ability to recreate the magnificent architecture of that cathedral. But there is one thing that can never be rebuilt, and that is the genetic component of a people. Once that is lost, it's gone for good. The preservation of the gene pool, which makes us unique and other ethnic and racial groups, is fundamental to the well-being of that group or society. The connection of individuals to the wider community is the key relationship here. We're not a group of individuals. That connection is absolutely essential to a healthy society. It's a very fragile thing which can be easily broken, and we've seen it being broken in recent years here. Absolutely, our young folk need to be educated that we are mere links in a chain, and that the education system must prepare the next generation of our boys and girls to become the cultural and spiritual, as well as the material heirs of our Western-based civilization and the Western Imperium. There are very few problems that cannot be overcome. I mentioned some of the worst things about the Industrial Revolution: the toxicity, the destruction of pristine landscapes, eradication of species, and so on. When we have a wholesome society where we have leaders that think for the long term and not for the next 5 years, when we have institutions that are run for the prosperity of the community and not just for a small, effete academic elite, when those structures are in place, nothing can stop us. All the ills of the past we can redress in terms of landscape preservation and so on, so we can have another golden age of an unpolluted British countryside ahead of us. When alienation and drifting have become replaced by proper commitment and firm guidance, as I said, there is nothing that we cannot achieve as a people. There's one final thing I want to say about PA. PA must continue to be built and developed with people who have a vision. We attract too many people in this organisation and indeed the wider nationalist movement. We attract far too many people who come to us with mere grievances. They need to understand our vision. One man or a woman with a vision, an understanding of this vision, is worth a thousand of those who come to us with a grievance. And the way to recruit someone is someone who already has a modicum of that vision, people who already hold on to some kind of faith of their own. It's very hard to get across to the deracinated masses. We need to look to people who already have some degree of their own vision, some degree of their own faith. I was going to say, we have too many moaners in our organisation who view or who use PA both in real life and on online chats as a way of whinging about the state of the country and moaning about their personal lot. That's fine, but it's not good enough. We need more men and women to realise what our vision is. And that is, initially, the creation of resilient local communities. Initially independent, but operating under an umbrella of mutual cooperation. These will be the foundation stones of our future ethno-state. And once they appreciate that vision, they will help realise and fulfil it. I say, let the wreckers, the destroyers, the breakers, the nihilists, let them wallow in their own created mire of filth and nihilism. Let them rot in hell. Whereas let us, every single one of us on our side, the creators, the producers, the makers, to continue on our own upward path to establish a glorious future, which is our own heaven built here on earth. Thank you.